Welcome back to FTI Consulting's Step Up Series, a podcast that explores the buzz of starting up as an entrepreneur, scaling up global companies, and stepping up to the societal challenges that business leadership can help fix. Today, we meet Piers Linney, entrepreneur and former dragon on BBC's Dragon's Den, interviewed by our very own Rob Mindell, Managing Director in London.
Piers, it is fantastic to speak to you again, and we're going to have a great conversation today, charting through your successful career.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm always interested about how I get introduced. It changes every time, everything I do.
Well, we are going to spend the next 20 minutes or so going through your illustrious career, and why don't we start at the very beginning? Young Piers Linney, full of ambition, qualified lawyer, then going on to investment banking, and suddenly the late 90s, early noughties entrepreneurial buzz catches you.
A lot further back than that. So my first business was when I was 13. So I had a I used to live up north. I'll do the short version of this, don't worry. I lived up north, I had a paper round. In those days when it snowed, it literally covered your car. And I thought, this is a mug's game, earning £5 a week, shows it all down. And I thought, you know, and my dad and my neighbour said, oh, I can't bother getting the paper on Sunday because they didn't deliver. And I said, okay, I'll go and get it for you. So I rode down my BMX, picked them up. They paid me a bit more money than I thought they would do. And I thought, hang on a minute, there's a business here. So I fly the whole neighbourhood, in fact, the whole town almost. And I built up a Sunday paper round. I did it Sunday, a couple of hours, and I earned 20 quid. So I very quickly in that micro business, I learned everything you need to know about, you know, having a niche, monetizing it, working very hard, and you know, building customers, and you know, and keeping customers, and finding new customers. And then when I was doing my A levels, I was had a side business selling sort of like you know, household goods and even perfume at some point. And when I was at university, I was doing parties. When I was at law school, I was forming limited companies. And when I was a trainee solicitor, I was in the film finance game, raising money for films. So the entrepreneurial bug you mentioned definitely didn't start after I left the city. I built businesses. I had businesses where, you know, I had to sell them in a fire sale. They've been very, very, very sort of difficult times, actually. You know, a lot of the employees I'm still very close to. In fact, I'm now starting a new business. Some of them that work with me, you know, on the up and some cases on the down, they're left very well paid jobs. In fact, far better paid jobs than I can pay them to do on my new business. So that tells you something about perhaps me and the people I've worked with and my leadership staff.
Amazing. And what the key difference between those early dot-com noughties businesses compared to the entrepreneurial flair you may have shown in your childhood is really that digitally enables nature to those businesses, right? It is about technology, creating opportunities, creating ways for innovators and entrepreneurs like yourselves to do something differently, do something new.
Yes, I've always been interested in I remember reading the book a while ago, the new thing. So it's always been technology and the next thing in many ways. And what I've always focused on has tended to be, you know, the good old TMT, technology, some media. I don't just mean being in front of the camera either, and telecommunications, and usually the convergence of technology and telecommunications. And actually, you mentioned there that I've been very focused on how technology can help, you know, entrepreneurs and small businesses, you know, make more money, reduce risk, and reduce their costs. And my new business, actually, Moblox, brings together everything I've ever done almost into one neat package. And the business is purely being set up to help small business owners and owner-led businesses, so it would include startups too, to embrace technology and modern business tools, because they don't, they should do. Our productivity in the UK is not as high as it should be, especially amongst our small businesses. It's well documented, it's baked into the industrial strategy. So my new business basically is designed to do exactly that.
Amazing, amazing. Through this series, we've spoken to a number of entrepreneurs on starting up, and many about this idea of scaling up. But you have a very interesting perspective on, or at least interesting experience to share, on actually the point at which you exit. And you've exited a number of businesses successfully, and some, as you mentioned earlier, painfully. And, you know, and you've got to think about all stakeholders in that. It'd be great just to hear your perspective, having seen the businesses through life cycles, about as an entrepreneur, as a business owner, when's the time to step away?
Yes, my background's actually M&A. So I'm kind of an M&A professional. So I bought many businesses. In fact, quite a few of the businesses that I've ended up building into reasonably large companies, they started with an acquisition. It might have been a small one and we built it. Or we built them through acquisition as well, or a mixture of acquisition and organic, tends to be the case. And I've sold quite a few businesses as well. You know, you tend to have to. I've floated businesses as well, not particularly successfully yet. Although I probably never will do again, actually. I'll probably bring in a CEO to do that for me. But I've sold quite a few, both to sort of financial buyers and also trade. I think your question is a very difficult one to ask because it's quite personal. It depends on the business. Clearly, if you are taking on external investment, equity as opposed to debt, they are expecting a return, those investors, and they're expecting you to buy them out or to be bought out by somebody else or to, you know, list on a market so they have liquidity and they can eventually sell down their shares and get their money back with a profit. So depending on how you structure your business, what your business does, how you finance it, can in many ways place you on a track to a particular end game, to a particular result. The danger of venture sometimes is that, you know, you raise 2 million, they're expecting to get 5 back. Yeah. You bring someone else in at 5, they're expecting to get 15, 20 back, and you keep going, or even more, 10 times, 20 times. And you keep going, and you can sometimes find that you're a passenger in your own business. So I think you've got to be very careful. But what I would say is that some people I know have built businesses to sell, and they almost knew who they were going to sell it to before they actually built it. And they were successful in doing that. I met people that built a business to sell, and the intended acquirer or acquirers weren't playing at the time. They wanted to sell it because they had other things to do because they're very big companies. And sometimes, you know, it's just the wrong day of the week. And they struggled. Eventually they got out, but not as clean as they would have liked to. But the point is you've got to build a business that you're building a business for the right reasons, which is to add value for your customers. And you're building a business somebody wants to buy, not a business to sell. That's the secret.
What a great piece of advice and warning for entrepreneurs as well, particularly as you see in private funding, you know, every letter of the alphabet being used always as Series Z fundraisers. And actually, at what point do you become that passenger of the business? Perhaps something we will unpick and explore a bit later. But one of your larger exits, I guess, just preceded when you became a dragon on BBC's Dragon's Den. And we can't have a conversation with Piers Lenny without talking about Dragon's Den. I mean, it must be a transformative experience. But tell us a bit about it and what it did for you personally, and also for the people you met, the approach from seeing investment portrayed on television compared to how it really is in real life.
Yeah, so Dragon's Den was one of those things that people ask me, how many times did you apply? And I'm kind of like, it doesn't work like that. They approached me. I was a secret millionaire on Channel 4 in 2011. Yeah. People who either saw it or you didn't. And actually, one of the guys I met who was in prison, I actually ended up training him, employing him, making him redundant, which was an awkward day. He started a business. He became an IT contractor consultant. And I'm still talking to him, supporting him. Not that I need to really these days. He's got a new job earning 70 grand. So he's earning more than me now in terms of income, probably. So anyway, so I digress. So I was then asked to, you know, do you want to be on Dragon's Den? And I was kind of like, oh, really? I was quite busy at the time. I wasn't too sure about being I was always a kind of reluctant celebrity, really. But eventually I joined, and I was actually away with, believe this or not, this is a true story, with Sir Richard Branson in Ulusabra's private game reserve. Well, I'll cut this long story short as well. And I was basically thinking, who the hell do I talk to about being an entrepreneur and business and the media and how you combine the two and the pros and the cons? And the obvious answer was Sir Richard. And I had a chat with him over a corona. He sort of told me to, you know, the media is very strong. You'd be good at it. You should do it. Screw it. Just do it. And I kind of said, oh, okay. And he goes, no, ring them. Actually, maybe ring the producer there and then and say, I'm in. And that's how I ended up on Dragon's Den. True story.
That's it.
And then, oh, you arrive there, there's no prep really, and you're just sort of thrown into it. And these people come out and they start pitching. I think what people don't realize is a couple of things. One is that, you know, business is not particularly televisual. You know, it's not Britain's Got Talent, is it? You're not going to get some other dog jumping through a hoop. Although I did try and do a few stupid things on the program, I think it wasn't quite that bad. And the point is that, you know, you've got to make that story interesting on TV. So you see an edit. So the edit is sometimes a 3 or 4 minutes, and sometimes they can be 12 minutes, kind of a long version. They could be there for an hour and a half, you know, even 2 hours. You think about it, they do a pitch, they ask questions, there's five people, there's a bit of to and fro. That's an hour before you even start. So that's it. So the producer have to find a story or a path through that that makes it interesting and keeps you engaged, so you don't switch over and watch Gogglebox, whatever the hell was on at the same time.
As an investor, due diligence must be so important when you're thinking about parting with capital to invest with an entrepreneur and an idea that you believe in. And that's just not possible in a kind of studio setup, surely. So there must be a lot off camera that you would have done when you were looking to invest in Lost My Name or investing in Mainstage Travel or anything else that you've come across.
Sort of. So it is quite like, in terms of if you ignore the cameras for a moment, in terms of the process, so someone pitches to you, you're looking at them, obviously, in most cases, because it's the individual you're actually backing in these early stages, as much as their business, and can they survive, you know, the sort of difficulties that they're going to be faced with building a business? Can they pivot, and can you work with them? That's the first thing. Then you're looking at the business. When you shake the hand afterwards, you know, you don't just sort of see them out back in the green room and hand them a brown envelope with cash. You go through due diligence. They enter into a shareholders agreement. You do the process just as though it was any other angel investment. So you do go through that process, and I'd say a third, probably a bit higher now, of Dragon's Den deals don't happen, either because they, you know, they pulled a fast one, that they're just for the PR. Secondly, you've done the due diligence, and you know the story they told you isn't quite true, or something just, you know, the world changes, something changes, or you know the business moves on, and they don't need your money, whatever might happen. So lots of reasons why the deals don't happen. I think I shook hands on, I think, 9. Probably did 6 or 7, I can't remember exactly. I think I got out of, said did 6. I got out of 5 of them, got out of 4 of them, got my money back basically. One, I probably lost my money. And one, you know, is a massive, huge success. Probably the most successful investment ever on Dragon's Den, and the first tech deal that was done on the show properly.
Well, let's talk about that great tech success. And for those that know it, I'm sure the parents among our listeners will know it very well. Was called What Lost My Name and is now called Wonderbly. And after you discovered them, or you backed them and saw something with high potential, Google Ventures then followed not too long after. And being that investor early on and seeing a large global outfit being able to turbocharge them even further, it'd be interesting just to hear a bit about that experience and how that business has transformed with you as an investor advisor along the way.
Yeah, so I like to think, and I like to say, could be wrong, but I don't think I am, that was the first real proper tech deal done on Dragon's Den. So the founders, very bright, PhDs, and knew what they were talking about. They had somebody understand, you know, psychology. Someone was a creative. Someone understood technology. They had all the pieces of the puzzle you might need. They had a term sheet from a VC fund that I knew of, which helps. I mean, someone's kicked the tires. And then a beautiful product, which they, you know, they handed out. And I thought, hang on, you know, so I invested £100,000 for, I think it was a bit of negotiation. I got to 5%. They wanted 4. I got 5 eventually. You know, and like any other angel investor, when you're a dragon, you get your SES, EAS tax break. So I got a bit of that money back. So it was quite a nice sort of entry valuation, essentially. And that company now is doing, you know, tens of millions, is profitable. As you said, it's been backed by some pretty serious investors, and at some point it will exit. And that could be, you know, a real winner, both for me personally, I guess, but also more for the program to demonstrate that you can do those kind of deals. You know, I was walking away with 5%. And I remember in the green room afterwards, my fellow dragons, I'm not sure what you call a group of dragons. I'm sure there's a collective now, a flock of dragons that were sort of having a go at me, saying, oh, that's not the kind of deal you do on Dragon's Den, and that deal is never going to happen, because we had to kind of agree this last 1%. Eventually, you know, we did the deal, and it's turned into a winner, and it's been fantastic to see that business. It doesn't matter, you know, wherever I go, and I think it was all Dragon's Den, what's it? And I say, you're a parent, and they say, yes, and I mention the name, and they literally, everybody has got one of their books somewhere on a shelf.
I bet Peter Jones and Deborah Meader are kicking themselves still to this day.
I don't think people do. I think there's lots of things. There's ones that I thought, oh, I'd like to have done that deal. Well, you just didn't, you know. And some you win, some you don't. I don't think if you're a serious investor, you worry too much about the ones that got away.
Well, we should probably talk about things beyond just BBC TV shows. One of the things on this series is called the Step Up Series for a reason, which is that we see plenty of entrepreneurs, business leaders like yourselves, Piers, who want to step up. They've seen businesses that have scaled up, they've started up their own business themselves, but they see challenges being presented, particularly in light of COVID-19, where they're stepping up to those challenges and they are helping other entrepreneurs step up. You are an advisor to many organizations, but one being the British Business Bank, and we were discussing last week the Alone Together report from last year, looking at diversity and inclusion within the entrepreneurship landscape, particularly in relation to funding. And it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts about that, your involvement in that project. And I know you are involved in a number of passionate projects, including some you discovered when on Secret Millionaire. So it'd be great to hear more from you about the challenges facing entrepreneurs from Black and ethnic minority backgrounds.
Yes, diversity is something that I'm very passionate about. I have been on, I've been on that journey. I know what it's like. I was quite sort of determined and bloody-minded and probably blinkered. So I wasn't too bothered by people that got in my way. I kind of always found a way around them. But a lot of people aren't like that. And the core issue is this, is if you want to have a fair society, the top of it needs to look like the bottom, basically. And therefore, where you were born or what postcode you were born in or what school your parents went to, shouldn't really have any bearing on the opportunity that you have to, do the best, do the most you can do with the life you have. And, the society is structured in ways where that isn't the case. Now, a lot of the time until quite recently, when I talk about my journey and when I talk about the fact that I just don't see people like me, I didn't see them in the city. It's changed a bit now, but I didn't see people when I was in the city, on either side of the fence, be it, the investor or even the professional advisor or the banker or the client. And that kind of frustrated me and it kind of concerned me. But my evidence was all anecdotal. So British Business Bank was something I really got behind, had issued or commissioned some research called the, as you said, the Alone Together report. And there's also some research by Extend Ventures that came out about the same time, which I also supported. And the way I summarize this is that it looked at BAME, so Black, Asian, Minority, Ethnic Entrepreneurs, compared to the sort of the white counterparts in the population, in terms of entrepreneurship and access to capital. And what it found was this, was that BAME entrepreneurs invest more money in their businesses. They spend more time working on their businesses. They start more businesses. They're better qualified, but their outcomes are worse. So no matter how you measure the outcomes, they're worse basically. And the way I liken this is the way I pictured it in my head is that if you're a Black, Asian, Minority, Ethnic entrepreneur and you're looking to start a 100-meter race, you're looking at the track, you're looking down your lane, everyone next to you, the other runners, have got the same kind of ability, got the same kit, you've all done the same kind of training, kind of all quite similar in a way. Then you're asked to start 20 meters back just because, your journey's longer because typically your socioeconomic background has been a more difficult one. So it is a longer journey, even if you're heading for the same end game, which might not be. Yours might just be, I want to provide for my family and buy a house, not get a 90-foot yacht instead of a 60-foot yacht.
We can all dream.
Yeah, so what you then realize, looking down your lane, that there's hurdles and that no one else has got hurdles in their lanes. You're like, okay, I can see the hurdles. I get it. I'll deal with them as I approach them. You start the race, you're running down your lane and you realize then not only the hurdles you can see, there's a load of hurdles that you can't see. They're invisible. It's just breaking your shins on. So that's what it's like. And if you're a woman, when you start that race, you're starting 50 meters back. And there are more invisible hurdles. So that's not fair. The access to capital should not be a function of, your ethnicity or where you're born. And the issues are this. There's two issues, really. One's financial capital, one's social capital. And financial capital is about access to capital, the confidence, knowing where it is, knowing how to raise money, knowing how to approach institutions. And social capital is about who you are, where you came from, your networks, your family, what job you had, do you have any savings? And obviously, social capital is very much linked to financial capital because if you've got the right networks, you're probably more capable of raising finance or at least knowing where it is. And Extend Ventures, their research, will use machine learning and computer vision to analyze the sort of PR VC funds, basically. And they found that, the one Black woman had raised a Series A round in the UK in the last decade. So this is terrible news and it needs to change because essentially ignoring all the you know, the kind of heated debate around this issue sometimes is that all we're really doing is leaving a huge amount of talent, energy, and GDP on the table. And, you know, essentially everyone will be in business within a generation, I think. And having people have more access to the capital you need to power those businesses isn't good for anybody.
And Piers, you've lent your voice and your profile to highlighting awareness of the issue, awareness of the problem, awareness of the missed opportunity within the UK and more internationally. So what do we do about it? Where do we go from here?
Well, I'm also honoured to be on the Diversity Advisory Council at Sky. And I joined that because Sky is, you know, Sky's an amazing organisation. It's got, you know, 33,000 employees, 24 million subs across Europe. And, you know, that's a good example of an organisation. This was after the George Floyd murder. They understood that both, you know, externally, the management team, and internally, the employees, they thought, well, something's got to change. We need to do something. So they committed resource, you know, quite a lot of money as well, to doing something about it. And that, to answer your question, really, is what it's about. It's about doing something. Doing nothing is unacceptable. And, you know, if you're a very large organization like Sky, you have the resources to actually bring about some real change. If you are a middle manager in a business that everyone looks just like the same, everyone looks like you, do something about it. You know, talk to the powers that be. Even if you're recruiting people, just think about who are you recruiting. Think about your conscious bias and your subconscious bias. Although some people don't believe that conscious bias exists, it's just or subconscious bias. Is it subconscious or conscious? I think it's conscious, actually. It's just an excuse for poor behaviors. But think about, you know, why does your organization look like that? The research shows that, and this is really going out to anyone who's running a business, is that the research shows, that's McKinsey, you know, whichever research you want to point at, that diverse businesses are stronger businesses, they're more profitable businesses, they have less risk in them, and they serve their customers more effectively. So diversity is now your job if you're a CEO. So go and think about that. And again, we're now, globalization means that you never know where your customers are. You need to, if you don't have that kind of diversity, you're probably taking on and operating with more risk than you probably need to. You need to understand the world around you and your customers and your supply chain. Otherwise, you are doing yourself, your business, and your stakeholders a disservice.
Well, what a fantastic rallying call. And as building back better seems to be very much of the zeitgeist at the moment, I'm sure, Piers, with Moblox, you are building back better and building an organization that's going to support SMEs, going to support other entrepreneurs in an even better way possible for a more productive future, benefiting from all of those years of entrepreneurship, all of those experiences that we've just touched on the last 20 minutes. But for now, Piers Linney, serial entrepreneur, advisor to many, and champion of diversity, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I hope to come back soon.
Thank you for listening to FTI Consulting Step Up Series. For more information, head to fticommunications.com and subscribe on Audioboom so you never miss an episode.